Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This year's deadline for college financial aid is fast approaching. The big application form for most students is due next week. But even with aid, the average American college graduate now leaves campus with a diploma and $21,000 in student loans. For graduate students, you can double that. We've come to accept it as par for the course. My guest today says that debt is much more dangerous and exploitive than it needs to be, and can and does steamroll borrowers who haven't read the fine print. He calls it a scam. This hour on Point, life and debt for college grads. You can join the conversation. Are you on top of your college loans, or are they on top of you? Do you see a problem with the system? Joining me now from Seattle is Alan Michael Cullinge, founder of StudentLoanJustice.org and author of the new book, The Student Loan Scam, The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History and How We Can Fight Back. Publishers Weekly calls it whistleblowing at its finest. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. So you're the poster boy for student loan debt and anger. What happened to you, sir?
Well, my own personal story goes something like this. I originally borrowed $38,000 for undergraduate and graduate school. Upon graduation, I got a fairly prestigious but also fairly low-paying job as a scientist at the California Institute of Technology. I found myself underemployed for a brief amount of time, about a year after September 11th, 2001. And so I requested what's known as a forbearance from my lender, which would allow me to postpone payments for 6 months or a year while I got my financial situation under control. Well, unfortunately, instead of granting my forbearance, although I fully was qualified to receive it, I was put into default status instead. And very quickly, my loan crescendoed from what was an original $38,000 to $82,000 within a little over a year after they defaulted it.
Ouch.
And as of 2005, I was being billed over $100,000. And this is despite my best efforts to negotiate with first the lender, then the guarantor and their collection companies, and finally and currently with the Department of Education. So I began to do a bit of research into this, and what I found was quite compelling. In fact, it can be far more profitable for the lenders when a loan falls into default rather than remaining in good stead. This is because of the government guarantee that stands behind it, and also the fact that nearly every standard consumer protection that we come to expect for every other type of loan in the country are non-existent for student loans.
We'll look at those. You've got a huge bill of grievances here, and it goes all the way from what happens when you get in trouble to the terms and interest rates and how students get pulled into these. You take it all the way up to a kind of, I don't know, a kind of alliance almost, you're suggesting, between colleges charging very, very big bucks, growing much faster than inflation, and these lenders who get people over a barrel. You point out, you say student loans barely existed 40 years ago. Today, American citizens borrow close to $90 billion a year to attend college, growing very rapidly, an industry grown up around that. And you say that it's led to a kind of a stranglehold on millions of lower and middle class students. I mean, the word you end up putting on it right on the cover of your book is scam. That's pretty strong language.
Yeah, that's correct. And anybody who looks at it is compelled to agree that by its very structure, it is a predatory debt instrument. In fact, this is sort of anecdotal, but there is a student loan collection company in Indianapolis, Indiana, that literally has a 4,000-gallon shark tank in their corporate headquarters. And as I mentioned before, this exists by virtue of congressional action, which removed bankruptcy protections, which removed statutes of limitations, which took away the right to refinance student loan debt at better terms. Many people don't realize that after graduation and consolidation of your debt, you cannot refinance that debt. You're stuck with whatever lender you consolidated with for the life of the loan.
Whatever deal you've got, that's it for the life of the loan, whether you can find a better offer or not.
That's right. And you know, a lot of people graduated in the 80s when interest rates were very high, and they were locked into 9, 10, 11, or more percent interest rates. And although there are lenders out there willing to give them a better deal, it's literally illegal to refinance this debt.
Let me ask you, we're going to look at a lot of the details, but this charge scam is pretty strong. I mean, people need to go to college. College is expensive. A lot of folks can't afford it out of the cash they've got, or their parents can't afford it either. The loans look important. There's no collateral here. There's no car or house for this lender to take back if students don't pay. I remember years ago, I'm not sure exactly when this was, but there was a whole flurry of stories about how many Americans were not paying back their student loans. I mean, what makes it a scam? People need to borrow the money. The money's being lent. The terms presumably are laid out in front of these students before they sign on the dotted line. What's the problem?
I'm glad you bring that up, Tom. You know, almost everybody points to, you know, back in the 70s when all the consumer protections I mentioned were on the table for student loans. Mm-hmm. For instance, when student loans were able to be discharged in bankruptcy, there's a ton of stories going around about, you know, these people would borrow a ton of money, graduate from school, and then promptly file bankruptcy in order to skate on their debt. Mm-hmm. And this was used as a reason for Congress to first restrict and then ultimately remove nearly completely bankruptcy protections from student loans. Well, in retrospect, it turns out that during this time, far less than 1% of federally guaranteed loans were discharged through bankruptcy. So, in fact, there was no bad behavior on any significant scale on the part of the borrowers. In fact, one congressman at the time said that it was really a crisis only in the imagination of the student loan industry.
Well, what about the crisis you're describing, though, now? They say it's only something like, what, a couple of percent or 5% over 10 years that default on their student loans. Is that a crisis?
That's another fantastic point you bring up. In fact, you know, the Wall Street Journal reviewed my book yesterday, and they brought up this fact. They said, look, you know, defaults are very low. Look, it's less than 5%. Well, in actual fact, that 5% figure only counts the loans that go into default in the fiscal year after the fiscal year in which the loans became payable. It's a little confusing, but roughly only 2 years after graduation does that figure account for, when in actual fact, the true default rate for student loans is somewhere between 20 and 30%. So this is between 1 in 4 and 1 in 3 borrowers. Now, often, and this is sort of where the scam kicks in, as I said, it can be far more profitable for the lenders when students default on their loans than if their loans remain in good stead. This is because some of the big lenders, like, for instance, Sallie Mae or Nelnet, these companies own not only lending companies, but they also have collection companies, and they serve these what's called a guarantor function as well. So in the case of like Sallie Mae, for instance, they can default a loan and be paid nearly full book value for this loan by the Department of Education. And then they can come back for sort of a second bite of a much bigger loan inflated with astronomical penalties and fees. And so we're finding these ridiculous cases where it turns out that the lenders are defaulting student loans without even attempting to collect on the debt.
A lot of people pay back their student loans, you know, on time, in full. There's been a lot of skepticism about subprime borrowers who maybe bit off more house than they can chew. Maybe people are just biting off more education than they should. Maybe they're just getting it, you know. Why shouldn't they be expected to pay it back if they've taken these loans full and fair and it must be laid out what they're going to pay on the way in? Why shouldn't they be expected to pay them back?
Sure, and I agree with you. I mean, like anybody, if you borrow money, you should have to pay it back. But in the case of student loans, well, number one, the lending system behind colleges in general has led to an insanely inflationary environment where the colleges and universities have raised their tuition at about double the consumer price index for decades running since the 70s.
And you're saying they do that because they can, and they can
because
the lending is there.
Precisely. Instead of, you know, going to your state government and asking for funds, it's far easier just to increase tuition and, you know, and we're seeing the results. This shift in burden from, you know, the state to the students combined with this massive increase in cost has led to the situation where we are today, where students, you know, these are not fraudulent people looking to rip off the system. These are people simply looking to better themselves and better the country through higher education. So, you know, once they're accepted into a college or university, they will sign nearly whatever is put in front of them. And, you know, it is only until recently that students and their families have begun to, you know, speak out a little bit about the incredible costs that they are expected to bear. And also, you know, students are rarely told, even today, despite what many colleges will tell you, if you look at entrance loan counseling forms, you will see that the fact that bankruptcy protection doesn't exist largely for student loans.
Even if you go bankrupt, your student loans don't go away. Mm-hmm.
That's correct. And this fact and the fact that you can't refinance, the fact there's no statute of limitations, the fact that very Orwellian and draconian collection tools are provided to the industry, including wage, tax return, even Social Security and disability income garnishment, all without a court order, make it an extremely lucrative debt when students default. All this is not told to the borrower before they sign their loan documents, and it's, you know, usually far too late after graduation when they realize the intractable and insurmountable and hugely growing debt that they've been stuck with. And so, you know, people that default on their loans are typically decent people who, for one reason or another, had, you know, a medical crisis, a messy divorce, a prolonged period of unemployment, something that was, you know, largely beyond their control. And where they think they may have a bankruptcy protection if their life is completely upside down, it doesn't exist.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the student loan business, my guest says racket, and how it rolls over American borrowers who are not very careful. Alan Michael Collins is with us. He's founder of studentloanjustice.org and author of the new book, The Student Loan Scam, The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History and How We Can Fight Back. And Alan, we've got a lot of listeners who want to jump in here. Let's go to Florida, Estero, Florida, and Teresa. Teresa, you're on the air.
Hi.
How are you? Fine. What do you know?
Well, I actually was saying I was kind of laughing about $20,000 and $40,000 of school debt. How about $130,000, $150,000?
Sounds crazy.
I went to medical school, and that's what I owe. And my biggest scam that I feel like I experienced is I was explaining that as you're going to school, you're borrowing multiple loans each year, and you're deferring until you get out and you can begin repayment. Well, once you go to repay, they encourage you to consolidate your loans. Consolidate. You'll make one loan payment a month.
Okay.
Well, what they don't tell you is you are locked in at that interest rate, and I ended up paying an interest rate of 8.5%. And a year or two later, that rate went down to about 2 to 3%. And I cannot refinance those loans. And I'm paying an enormous amount of interest beyond what I borrowed. I mean, I'm going to be paying those loans off until I'm 65.
Literally? Have you calculated it out? Literally?
I literally calculated it out. I'm a primary care doctor. I'm not a big wig neurosurgeon. I don't make millions of dollars a year. So,
but you're a doctor. You're a smart person. Are you sure that they didn't tell you were going to be locked in there? Wasn't it right there written down on what you signed?
No, it was not.
No.
It was not.
No.
And it's very frustrating. And
wow.
I don't really see a way out of it. But something does need to be done. And I was so happy to hear somebody actually discussing it. I mean, you could refinance your house mortgage payments and get cheaper interest rate. And why can't I went to school to get an education to better myself and be a better part of society, and I can't refinance my student loans to get a more competitive rate.
Alan, what do you say to Teresa's story?
You know, I get that complaint all the time. It's probably a good 20% of the complaints that I get at studentloanjustice.org. And I will give you a bit of history on this. You know, this can be attributed to the lobbying activities of Sallie Mae, which began as a government-sponsored entity and then privatized in 1995, but carried with them a tremendous amount of influence on Capitol Hill. There are a lot of lenders out there who wanted students to be able to refinance their debt under better rates in a competitive environment. And until recently, this was actually possible through a sort of vague, ambiguous loophole that somebody found, whereby somebody could consolidate into the direct program from wherever they were consolidated in and then back out into the FFELP program, which stands for Federal Family Education Loan Program. So refinancing was possible for a brief amount of time through this sort of strange loophole. Well, Sallie Mae and their lobbying machine put an end to it in 2006, I believe. And so while there was a narrow window where, and believe me, students took advantage of this by the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, those who were able to find out about it. But yes, your guest, your caller is completely right. And Teresa, you know, I wish you well, and I would hope that you would come to studentloanjustice.org and tell your story and sort of help us join forces as a citizens group.
Teresa, good luck with that. Well, think of you paying till you're 65. Alan, we invited Sallie Mae to bring a representative on the show. They declined, but they gave us a statement. And they said, we're proud of our record in helping more than 21 million Americans achieve the dream of higher education. And they said, it's important to note that when a borrower fails to repay their taxpayer-subsidized student loan, the rules and procedures that every single lender must follow are prescribed by Congress and the U.S. Department of Education, not Sallie Mae. I mean, they're saying, look,
you know,
we're just following the law.
Sallie Mae declines to be interviewed everywhere I go. You know, I went on 60 Minutes 2 years ago. Same thing. They declined to show up. And, you know, they always point to the taxpayer dollars as, you know, being so important to preserve and save.
Well, why not? Those are pretty important.
I agree with you completely. But here's the real story. The Department of Education, for every dollar they pay out for defaulted loans, they get back $1.20. So they are not losing money. The Department of Education is making money, likely, on defaulted student loans. The only taxpayer money that is wasted or, you know, spent in the student loan system is in the subsidies that are paid to the lenders, like Sallie Mae. And so I find their statements incredible. And I would just issue this challenge that if they truly want to have a debate via radio, television, or any other forum, I am completely open and willing to engage them.
So there it is. The gauntlet's thrown down. Students over a barrel in the meantime. Paul in Acton, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Paul.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm entering the front end of this. Well, I spent last week with my son going around through colleges all through Pennsylvania and New York. And one of the things that, and I'm also in middle class, and the tuitions have varied anywhere from around $40,000 up to as much as $50,000. And it's one of the things that most of the colleges don't even address in all of their initial rounds with juniors and seniors. And so I asked some questions, like how much has your tuition risen in the last, say, 4 years? And it ranges from 3 to 5%. And at that rate, you know, tuition is going to be costing $75,000 a year in 4 years. Now college is a necessity, and as a result, you know, you're going to be forced to borrow money, or go to state school. However, because everybody's wanting to get into the state schools now, only a small fraction of people within a state can actually get into the state school. So that option is rather limited as well. So you're between a rock and a hard place. And so I'm looking forward to a son who's interested in pre-med and looking at 7 or 8 years of education and student loans. And certainly for me, I'm going to have to tap my equity because there's no way I would want to borrow money.
And do you expect your son or daughter to come out the other end with a pile of loans as well, Paul?
I'm expecting that if they come out with loans, which they will, that it will be owed to me and not to any kind of borrower, because I'm very happy to hear your guest talk about this because it's a wake-up call for me as well.
Well, lucky for you if you can cover that, but then, you know, a lot of people can't. Alan, I mean, here's the story. Paul's been doing this in New York and down the East Coast. People, parents and children doing this all over the country in this season. And as you describe it, they're sort of getting forced into this sausage machine where they come out the other end owing a lot. If it can be to mom and dad, maybe that's okay. But a lot of people can't pull that off. And it's as though they're forced into this borrowing cycle.
Yeah. You know, and it's a really intractable situation for the vast majority of middle and lower income borrowers. And, you know, I really point to the student loan industry in collusion or cooperation, whatever you want to call it, with the universities, and I would say even with the blessings of the Department of Education, the sort of an unholy triangle, if you will. And, you know, the inflationary environment has got to – the bubble has got to burst eventually. You know, they talk about the subprime mess. Well, there are a lot of analogies to be drawn between what's happened in the subprime mortgage industry and what has been frankly happening for years in the student loan industry. You know, there is no choice but to borrow for this sort of commodity. But unlike the home mortgage industry, the lack of consumer protections really can ruin and is ruining lives, not only of the borrowers, but often of their families who end up co-signing on loans for them.
This is important. When the president last night in his speech before Congress was saying we've got to get more Americans getting more education after high school, Barack Obama and Michelle themselves, I remember hearing during the campaign, they had big law school debts that they were carrying all the way along, bigger than their monthly mortgage payment, until he wrote his books, Audacity of Hope and Dreams from My Father, and paid that off. But that took a while. Let's get a call from Madeline in Boston. Hi, Madeline. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I teach in a college, and I am just dismayed by the enormousness of the debt that my students are getting. And I have to agree with the previous caller. Financial aid departments don't tell the students everything. They're not there to serve the students. They're there to generate revenue for the college. But there's a bigger question in all of this. The students who do meet their obligations pay a huge amount of money with all the interest. The taxpayers subsidize that interest for part of the time. The taxpayers mm-hmm. also subsidize the students who default. Then we have these middlemen, the banks, that are making a killing. Now, if the students are paying and the taxpayers are paying, why don't we have a system like they have in Canada or Europe, where the taxpayers are subsidizing education, but the banks are not in the middle making a killing? This began under President Reagan, when he transformed grants into loans. And students coming into college are told, this is your financial aid package, and they think they're getting a great deal, and then they find out it's all loans. So I think we need to question the entire system in this country. We're the wealthiest country in the world, and our students go heavily into debt, and that does not happen in Canada and Europe.
Ought to be, maybe, another way to do this. Madeline, thanks very much for that. Alan Michael Collins, stand by for a second. I want to welcome into this conversation a voice from Washington. Kelly Field is with us. She's a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, covers Congress and education. Kelly, thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You know the complaint that Alan Michael Collins is raising in his book, The Student Loan Scam. You hear Madeline just calling in. She works for a small college near Boston. Sounds like she's describing, if not a scam, then maybe something well shy of an ideally arranged system. I mean, do we have a systemic problem with the way people end up paying for college? Is there some injustice in it, Kelly, or is it just what it costs and we got to grin and bear it?
Well, I mean, the college debt is definitely rising at an unsustainable level. Currently, the average student gets more in grants than in loans, but the debt burden is growing dramatically, according to the College Board. 60% of undergrads graduate with debt, and the average debt is around $22,700.
Is that sustainable? Is that just the way it goes? Do you see a scam in here? It's right in Alan's title.
I don't know if there's a scam, but it is definitely a burden for many people, and there's been an effort in recent years to expand loan forgiveness for public servants in various fields.
And why is it this way in the States and not, you know, elsewhere? I mean, could we somehow overhaul our system, look at what Canada's doing, and come out of this with good education and not a lifetime of debt servitude?
Well, people have been trying to do that for a long time. It is very difficult to hold down the cost of college. There are many factors that are driving it, including energy costs and personnel costs. So a bigger problem is trying to find out ways to pay for it without relying on loans so heavily.
Alan, how do you see that? What could we do with our system that would make this a less onerous problem for those who get caught in it?
Well, in my view, the first thing that we need to do is acknowledge the fact that the removal of these very basic standard consumer protections that we've come to expect with every other type of loan in the country need to be restored. There was really never any rational basis for removing them in the first place. And by restoring them, this will give the federal government a stake in the system where currently, you know, they could care less whether or not a loan defaults. In fact, on balance, it may actually be better for their book if students default. So we need to restore these standard consumer protections that people deserve and expect. And from there, the federal government will be in a position where perhaps they can exert a lot more influence over the colleges and universities to control their costs. And I know Kelly probably rightly mentioned energy, healthcare, and other costs that have led to you know, the increase in tuition. But you know, you can point to those factors for any industry. But we haven't seen the price of, you know, bread rise at double the CPI over the past, you know, three decades like we have colleges and universities. If you look at administrative salaries, you know, the president's salaries of colleges and universities, you know, drive past any school and you will see shining, you know, brand new brick and mortar projects. I think there are a lot of areas that the colleges could look to save costs while preserving the quality of their education.
Kelly, maybe it's all just become too gold-plated, you know, the climbing walls and the walnut paneling and all the amenities. Maybe we need to get back to cement floors and bunk beds.
And that is a complaint that you hear a lot. And recently, actually, there's been some talk about trying to go to a three-year college degree and that being a way to reduce the cost of college for students.
Let's get a call from Rex in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Rex, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I guess I have more of a comment than a specific question. Mm-hmm. I mean, I appreciate the fact that this book was written and this was brought to everybody's attention. I mean, I don't think everybody understands the complexities of the student loan process when you're in the beginning. I went to graduate school for 6 years, and each year that you take out a new loan, the loan is separate. And so they sell those loans to different people. And by the time I graduated, I probably had $120,000 in student loans. But they were all distributed throughout the country in terms of who owned them. I couldn't track them down. I couldn't find them. By the time I found them, I was in default on some of them. They then encouraged consolidation and told me that's the only way I could get them all in one place, which I did at a relatively high interest rate. But then come to find out they defaulted again because private loans can't be consolidated. So even though they told me they were all consolidated, they weren't. I had to go through a lengthy process. Now, I mean, I appreciate the fact that we were given the loans and I got the education that I got. But at the same time, when I get out, I've got now like $250,000 in student loans. Oh. I pay almost $2,000 a month in student loan costs. I've got to make over $100,000 just to live a basic life in order to pay these student loans back. And like you said, in terms of consumer protections, if anything happened where I lost my job, I would be bankrupt in a second, and it wouldn't matter. I'd still have to pay that $2,000 a year or a month in student loans, and I'm not even touching the principal.
Rex, hang tough. That's a very tough story. Alan, an unusual story?
No, not at all. In fact, you know, the complexity and the almost systemic confusion that students experience before, during, and after college with student loans is the rule rather than the exception.
You know, suggest that's on purpose.
Well, I'm...
Do they have the same disclosure rules that I have for a credit card? Do they have to spell it all out?
No. In fact, truth in lending, student lenders are specifically exempt from truth in lending requirements by law. This is another standard consumer protection that is off the table for student loans. So it's very convenient. You know, I'm not going to say it's on purpose. I'm not a conspiracy theorist necessarily, but the fact that it is confusing is very convenient for the lenders and just puts up one more hurdle that makes the students, you know, unable to be able to comprehend their situation. You know, I've got borrowers who have paid, accountants a lot of money over months to try and sort out their student loans. And these highly paid accountants could not sort out the just vast variety and, widespread, like your caller said, nature of these loans. And so, you know, this puts the borrower in a state of confusion where, you know, they basically, as I said, have no power. And they basically pay whatever they are told to pay. And if they don't pay, well, the results are, you know, very, very horrible. In fact, You know, I've got dozens of people who have come to studentloanjustice.org who have quite literally fled the country as a result of their student loans.
Wow.
It gets worse.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the student loan business. My guest says racket, and how it rolls over American student borrowers who are not very careful. Alan Michael Collins is with us. His book is The Student Loan Scam, The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History, and How We Can Fight Back. Alan Michael Collins joins us from Seattle. Let's get a call from Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona. And Renee, hi, Renee, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you so much for being so kind. This is a very serious situation. Alan has not yet mentioned that some people have committed suicide because they're haunted, like Jean Valjean of Les Miserables. And Alan hasn't yet mentioned that you have to pay even if you're disabled. And I would urge everyone to participate in that website of studentloanjustice.org, and maybe collectively we can address this to Congress. And co-signers, yes, be very careful, because the co-signers are liable for that. My question then to Alan is, collectively, would we be able to address Congress and other representatives? And thank you so very much.
You're welcome, and thanks for calling, Renee. Alan, suicide?
Yeah, she rightly mentions that. And you know, I'm a little hesitant to, you know, I don't like to discuss that subject too often. But yeah, indeed, we've documented three cases of suicides by people who were overburdened by their student loans, and they cited student loans as the reason for what they did.
What tends to happen? I mean, I don't know if we can draw a direct cause and effect there. Maybe, but what happens? How do people get in trouble?
Well, it can happen any one of a number of ways. I mean, first of all, some people are defaulted despite their best efforts to maintain their loans in good stead.
Why?
Some people never even hear from the student loan company until their loans are defaulted, and suddenly they're getting collection notices for, you know, far more than they originally borrowed, and there's no negotiation room because of the standard consumer protections that were removed. But, you know, in general, I would say that, you know, the standard reasons why people run into financial difficulty on credit cards or any other sort of debt in general, you know, a health crisis, a prolonged period of unemployment, perhaps a messy divorce, that sort of thing. But what, you know, for any other type of debt where there is at least some sort of recourse, you know, for student loans currently, there are none. And, you know, I know your caller was very interested in whether we can influence Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think we can. In fact, you know, I've been working at this for 3 or 4 years now. And I will say this. Hillary Clinton, after the 60 Minutes piece ran in May 2006, within 1 month, she had crafted, with our input, the Student Borrower Bill of Rights. Now, Student Borrower Bill of Rights would have returned many of the consumer protections, including you know, standard bankruptcy rights, refinancing rights, and others to student loans.
So what are the politics here? Why hasn't that passed? Who's fighting it? The Sallie Mae, which is now, as you point out, entirely private. The Mae indicates some government connection, but that's long gone.
Yeah, people think that they're part of the government, but and they are, in that they you know, basically have invaded and are currently, you know, encamped around and among our Congress, most often members of House and Senate Education Committees. But if you look at the lobbying expenditures of Sallie Mae, and they spend between $1 and $2 million every quarter lobbying, their influence goes far and wide. It's not really even a partisan issue. You know, they will give proportionally to Democrats and Republicans. But if you look at members of the House and Senate Education Committees, they are particularly influenced by Sallie Mae. And, you know, I could go on and on. And if you get the book, you can see some very dire examples of some of the financial benefits that senators and congressmen on both House and Senate Education Committees have received, either for them or their families, as a result of student loan contributions. But, you know, we're in a new day now. We've got a new president. We have a new Congress. And I think that people are more willing to look at loan instruments, not only home mortgage, but also other instruments that have, tended towards predatory over the past 8 years. And so I see a new hope, and I can, that's all that we can do is hope. And as citizens, don't be ashamed or intimidated by your situation. You know that 30% of students out there are defaulting on their loans.
Wow.
And like I said, often despite their best efforts to maintain their payment status in good stead. So, you know, you're not alone. And it really is up to us to coalesce and show Congress that there are a lot of people out here. And we do care about student loans, and we do care about consumer protections. You know, we want to be good citizens. We want to pay back a fair amount on our debt, but we don't think that our lives should be, tantamount to indentured servitude, paying triple, quadruple, or even more than what we originally borrowed, simply because
with no recourse.
With no recourse. Simply because Congress was, too influenced by the student loan industry.
Let's get a call from Michael in Bakersfield, Vermont. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I had actually a long spiel to give you, and it's just another story of another U.S. citizen that's been duped. U.S. veteran, got some time to go to college and still had to take some student loans, and my wife also. I just wanted to agree with the author in regards to student loan debt. Here I am 20 years later, and I'm still paying it. I have paid my share of fare back, and I still owe the same amount that we took out. I'll take, any other comments offline.
There's your lifelong indentured servitude picture. I'm sorry for that, Michael. Alan?
Yeah, that story is very typical. You know, we get a lot of service men and women that come to studentloanjustice.org. Often they're off on deployment and, their wives are handling the books or the other way around often increasingly. And but I would also add that, the average member of our organization is got to be over 40, I would think. These are not young, reckless students that come to our group. These are people in their 30s, 40s, and even beyond. You know, we have 70, 60, 70, even 80-year-old people who are having their disability and Social Security income garnished without a court order. Just to pay a small fraction of the penalties, fees, and interest that accrued on loans that they took out literally in the 60s.
Be careful. Let's get one from Stephen in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? It seems like everybody's got the same story, so I won't even go into it. But I started with $100,000, and now I owe $300,000.
Oh.
And last year, I declared bankruptcy. And my lawyer said the only way to get the student loans off is through an act of Congress. And so I was just wondering if you knew anything about that. If it's like, do I call my congressman or what?
Alan?
That's frankly, that's pretty much correct. You can discharge student loans in bankruptcy if you are basically totally and permanently disabled or obviously dead. but yeah, indeed, it is going to take a congressional action to make student loans treated like every other type of loan in the country. You know, the government guarantees a large array of loans, farm loans, ag loans, SBA loans, FEMA loans, et cetera. Many are unsecured, yet none of these other federally guaranteed loans have this very peculiar and unique absence of standard consumer protections. And so, I mean, to me, it seems like common sense, and I would hope that over time, the people in Congress will stop listening to the banks and start listening to their constituents.
Let's get another perspective here from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We're joined by William Bill Schilling. He's Director of Student Financial Services at the University of Pennsylvania. Bill Schilling, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, hi, Tom. You're very welcome. I'm glad to do it.
President Obama talking last night about how we need more higher education in this country, and then along comes Alan Michael Collins, and he describes what sounds like a real nightmare here, and he paints a picture, and I just want to get your perspective on it, of something like almost collusion here, a kind of racket where the colleges can jack up tuitions higher and higher. There's the student loan business ready to pump the money in, and then Americans are sort of caught in this trap for the rest of their lives. Do you see? Is there a systemic problem here, Bill?
Well, I think there are concerns, certainly, about debt. I'm looking at this from one very specific place at the University of Pennsylvania, where we have not seen some of the problems that you've been talking about.
How can that be true if a third of American students with debt end up defaulting? I mean, wouldn't you be part of a wave that big?
Well, we would, but we have not had any sense that, that defaults of our borrowers have been that high. I certainly on the federal loan side, the defaults have been under 5%. But I think there's a concern, certainly at the undergraduate level, that students are borrowing too much, and the answer to that is to reduce the price as much as possible, but even more than that, to increase the amount of grant that's available to offset that cost.
You know, Alan suggests that we may be reaching some kind of tipping point here, tantamount to what we've seen in the American housing market, which is just chunking down 10, 20, you know, 30% more, depending where you are, that it's just not sustainable, and that the lending that's gone in here is kind of the warning sign, and the defaults are the sort of the indicator of that. Is it? Do we have a kind of house of cards in tertiary education costs here that we can't sustain?
Well, we have a very varied higher education environment in the United States. And at some of the wealthier private institutions, there is sufficient money to make the net price lower in for students from lower and middle income families than at a lot of public institutions. I think that we still, most private institutions don't have a lot of endowment, and they have costs to pay, like health insurance for their staff and utilities, and it is harder for them to be able to get an affordable net price for all of the students that would want to go there. In terms of our overall the overall issue of access to higher ed, particularly four-year higher ed in this country, we're really not going to solve it until we can make sure that public institutions, four-year public institutions, are affordable, because that's where two-thirds of the seats are for undergraduates.
You know, Alan, here we've got Bill Schilling at a great school, University of Pennsylvania. He's director of student financial services. I can pester him with questions, but I'm curious what question you would put to him along the lines of your concern about student loans, Alan.
You know, I would ask Bill what effect the Student Loan Sunshine Act has had on the ground. You know,
what is that?
Elliot Spitzer, Attorney General, State of New York, a couple years ago, enacted an investigation, which ultimately found that financial aid administrators were taking kickbacks from lending institutions. And, you know, if you look at the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators, this is their sort of lobbying group of financial aid folks at the various colleges and universities, you know, you see that the majority of their funding comes from student loan companies. And so, you know, I'm just curious whether this situation, when it came to light, the Student Loan Sunshine Act was put forth, and I know a lot of universities agreed to various codes of conduct which would get rid of this behavior. And so I'm just curious if at UPenn and other schools, if Bill knows, if this legislation and this these codes of conduct have had an effect on the behavior of colleges in their relationships with lenders since that time.
Bill Schilling?
I think there certainly has been. I think it was Attorney General Cuomo, not Spitzer.
It began with Spitzer, and then Cuomo took it.
Yeah. I think what has happened is that the schools are meeting the requirements by having more lenders on their lender lists. There was a time when there might be only one or two lenders on a school's preferred lender list.
A little too cozy.
Well, yeah, but I know there were some cases I think, very bad judgment. But the banks are for-profit institutions, and they're going to market, and they're looking to make a profit.
But we expect the schools to be honest brokers when that young student sits down to sign a
loan. Yes, you do, and I think in the vast majority of cases, there were no situations where schools got into a relationship with a bank for the personal benefit of the financial aid office. There were some cases of bad judgment. But I think what has happened since is that schools have to have a more arm's reach relationship with lenders and have more lenders on their lender list. We have about 10 or 11 lenders on our various lender lists, our federal loan lists and our private loan lists. We issue requests for information to get as much information as we can about the lenders and about their products. Sometimes we have found, and I think other institutions have found, students and parents would rather not have to make a choice among 10 or 11 lenders. They really want to be told who they should borrow from, and they depend on the school to do that.
And they want to trust that the school is going to make a selection in their interest if it comes to that. Bill Schilling, we're about out of time here, but we're very grateful to you for joining us for a minute today. Thanks a lot for coming on. William Schilling at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm sorry for all the stories we're not getting to here. Megan and Ryan and Victor in Boise, Idaho. But, Alan, perhaps we've just got a minute here, but what is your advice? If you've got to take out that loan, what should people watch out for? How can they protect themselves within the system we've got right now until and unless it's changed?
I suppose it comes down to, practical advice given to borrowers of other loans. Read the fine print. Exhaust all of your federal loans before you go to private loans. Private loans that are not federally guaranteed often have far higher interest rates, and they also are lacking in consumer protections, including bankruptcy protection. So it's probably a marginally better deal to go with federally guaranteed loans first. Don't be afraid to haggle with your university. Don't take what the financial aid office gives you as the final word. Go back to them and see, if there's anything else they can do to decrease your loan burden. And ultimately, consult with your, friends, family, and parents, etc. And if you have to choose a different school for cost reasons, don't be ashamed.
Good advice, all of it, and we're grateful for it. Alan Michael Collins's new book is The Student Loan Scam, The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History and How We Can Fight Back. His website, if you want to check it out, is studentloanjustice.org. He joined us today from Seattle. Alan, thanks for your work. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It was a real pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Watch out for yourselves. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.